thanks everybody for being back here after the break. It's my pleasure to be here with you and tell you a little bit about my research. But you know, first of all, thanks the organizers for putting together this workshop, right? Which I'm happy to be part of. Now, without further ado, this slide probably already know the Webb telescope. Those two are fields taken with the Webb, Jade's fields, in which there might be some of the first stars in the universe. We don't know yet, but potentially there are. Now, this slide already, in view of Sarah's talk, is incomplete because there are the dark matter detection strategies based on, you know, the regular dark matter, not the atomic kind of dark matter. But either way, let me quickly go through the standard strategies. Ray detection, deep underground detectors, they exploit interactions between standard monoparticles and dark matter. Indirect detection, which is a lot of what I'm doing and a lot of what I presume in this workshop we're going to hear about, they exploit basically annihilation signals, let's say, in regions of high density of dark matter. And then we have the hope of actually producing those particles at accelerators, say LHC or other in the future. Either way, going back to indirect detection, astrophysical objects can serve as very powerful dark matter probes. And this is nothing new. This has been put forth ever since the 80s when the WIMPs were the prominent models, when people such as Gould, et cetera, you know, invented this formulas of dark matter capture, stating, hey, a dark matter particle crosses the Earth, the Moon, the Sun, and so on and so forth, could potentially be trapped in there. If there's sufficiently many of them trapped, they could generate signals that could be observed. Flip this idea on its head. If you don't see a signal, you can place constraints on dark matter, right? So that's, in a nutshell, the idea behind using astrophysical objects as DM probes. Now, in this list, which is incomplete, right, the ones I'm going to focus on today is the first stars. And as you can see, well, for the others are actual images of objects, or maybe not for a neutron star, but either way, here are actual images. For the first stars, I put a simulation because we didn't yet see any of the population 3 stars or dark stars, which are going to be the other side of my talk, right? We are informed by simulations on how they form, right? So let me briefly review this idea. They form those at high redshift in dark matter halos, but the key point here is that they form from pristine gas. In other words, hydrogen and helium. In other words, very poor cooling mechanism. And yeah, usually they do form in isolation. There is this question of fragmentation, how many fragments you could have. We're not going to debate now. You can ask me at the end of the talk. But either way, they could form in low multiplicity. They could be 10 per halo. They could be maybe 50. But in some cases, even as few as a few, right, per halo. And if, and that's a big if dark matter heating plays no role in the formation of those objects, you end up with what's called population 3 stars, which, well, they can be as massive as 8,000 solar masses, which, by the way, this is a huge mass, right? If it doesn't tell you something, 1,000 solar masses is a huge mass. But either way, they are powered by nuclear processes, by hydrogen fusion, right? That's the population 3 stars in a nutshell. And I'm going to just tell you right now, straight off the bat, that those guys can be really, really powerful probes of dark matter, right? So on those two, on this slide, the two pictures are forecast bounds on this spin-dependent and spin-independent cross-sections between dark matter particle and protons. If I assume there's a 300 solar mass POP3 stars, the band shaded with green, or if I assume there's a 1,000 solar mass POP3 star, conversely deeper exclusion limits, shaded with red, right? Notice, because we're placing those bounds based on the interaction with protons, they're the same left to right. There's no spin dependent versus spin dependent. The only thing that changes is the bounds from direct detection experiments, and spin dependent are weaker. I put here pico 60. By now, they might be a little bit deeper, but either way, the key message of this slide is that population 3 stars could probe below the neutrino floor of spin-dependent experiments. Now, there's an uncertainty here. This number, which maybe some of you in the back cannot read, is the density, dark matter density of the location of the star, which is assumed to be in a range of 10 to 13, 10 to 16. That's shocking, I know. I'll try to explain why we take those values. But either way, the reason we have bands, these broad strokes, is because, you know, for 10 to 13, you have the weaker bond, 10 to 16, you have the stronger bond, right? So now let's go back, if that's the main result. I want to acknowledge my former students who worked on this a lot. Actually, behind those plots is their blood, sweat, and tear. Caleb, Jacob, and Sam, now, you know, PhD students at various universities. But anyway, the plots I showed you are really, a lot of it is due to them. We're talking about population three stars, right? So far, those guys are hypothetical objects, but there's really, really strong indications that we're poised to observe the first population three stars. Maybe we have already observed some of them. So in 2020, with HST, Vanzella and others identify a system that's really a very strong candidate for such a population three star system, right? In which, if you have stars as massive as 300 or 500, you can explain this very strong Lyman alpha emission feature. Now, even the most distant star ever observed, Arundel, again with HST at redshift 6.2, could be explained as a population three star. It's not yet, this interpretation is not yet ruled out, even in view of James Webb data follow-up, right? So we might have candidates. We, in the future, as I said, with sufficient lensing, there's hope that James Webb definitely will be able to find population three stars in isolation. So now let me explain very briefly why are those such powerful probes, right? That's the takeaway message of my first half of the talk, but why? Well, again, they formed in very dark matter rich environments. They're very large, 1,000 star masses, that's a large object. And maybe even the key reason why, being so massive, they shine almost at the Eddington limit, right? So there's almost no room to add any heating to them. Why are the densities so high? Well, let's focus on this picture first, the right side. Simply, you have a gas cloud that collapses to form a star. The gravitational well is going to be heightened. In other words, any dark matter orbit, which is represented here by the circle, is going to shrink in. A collection of orbits, all of them shrinking in, leads to a much higher density at the center of the halo, which, again, let's see how that works with simulations. You start from standard NSW profile, and you introduce this mechanism, which is called adiabatic contraction. So whatever I'm talking about here, AC, let's agree we're going to call it AC from now on, adiabatic contraction, right? If this AC mechanism operates up to a number density, so there's different curves, different colors, let's say 10 to the 15 number density of baryons per centimeter cubed, well, look at that. What's happening at the dark matter density, it's increased in the inner parsec by, I would say, more than six order magnitudes. That's the 10 to the 16 I was talking about before. Let's say we're not assuming that it goes all the way up to the gas cloud collapse into 10 to the 15, but rather 10 to the 9. This curve, you still have an enhancement up to the 10 to the 10 or so, right? So that's my reason of justifying the density to be so high. But more than that, there's simulations. Those stars here are simulations of star formations embedded in a halo done in 2002 by Abel et al. They're cut here because, well, as you all know, simulations have a resolution limit. But either way, within the resolution limit, they match really, really well those tracks of adiabatic contraction, right? So dark matter densities, we believe that they could be as high as 10 to 13 or even higher. Now, very briefly, what's happening once a dark matter particle crosses a star? Well, it's going to scatter. Again, we assume that. We assume it's going to interact with protons, right? So it's going to scatter off of protons inside. It's going to lose energy. Eventually, it can get trapped inside that object. It can form a distribution of dark matter at the core, sometimes even weird enough. I'm not going to spend too much time on that, but it can even float the distribution. But either way, the dark matter that gets distributed inside can meet each other and annihilate and generate signals. Some of the signals are, oops, sorry. some said signals are neutrinos that escape and could potentially be detected. But what I'm interested in is the heat that gets thermalized inside this object, right? The extra power source, the power source from captured dark matter, which could increase the luminosity. And yeah, bear with me, one or two equations. The luminosity in dark matter should be equal, well, proportional to the annihilation rate times the mass of dark matter particle times this F, where F is the fraction of energy that's deposited inside the star, which is complementary to the fraction that's lost to neutrinos. This annihilation rate, well, very quickly, an equilibrium regime will be attained for most dark matter models we considered between annihilations and capture. So in the end, you can actually calculate it without knowing the microphysics of dark matter, but just knowing that it's going to, in equilibrium, the annihilation rate should be just capture per two. Because you cap to annihilate one event, you take two dark matter particles that are captured, right? So by the way, the takeaway message of this slide is the luminosity in dark matter is proportional to the capture rate, which is proportional to two important parameters, sigma, the one we constrained, and dark matter density, this product, right? So what we did here now, we just broke the degeneracy between sigma and dark matter density by assuming something about rho chi, 10 to the 13, 10 to the 16. Those are the plots. The physics is the following. There's a limit to which any object can shine, the Eddington limit, right? Let it be brighter, and it's going to blow away its atmosphere. So really, the physics is any object is limited in the amount of luminosity that it have to the Eddington limit. In other words, the sum of all power sources should be less or equal than the Eddington luminosity. And you can convert this bound into the bounds we've seen, right? So that's sort of the conclusion for my first part of the talk, which, well, top two stars could tell us about what dark matter cannot be. And maybe I'm going to allude to something you definitely may ask at the end or later. I didn't explore the sub-GeV region, but you might have noticed that if I were to naively extrapolate in the sub-GeV, those guys would be very strong, right? So maybe if you want to ask that question later, that would be great. If not, fine. Anyway, that's really what top two stars can tell us. They can tell us what dark matter cannot be, which maybe it's sad, maybe it's okay, I don't know. Depends on which one are you of those, but I'm going to take it objectively. This is only half of the story, right? Because we can go back to this idea. How did the first stars form? Do you really know how they formed? Remember, there was an assumption. The key assumption was dark matter heating plays no role in the formation of the first stars. But does it, right? And this question was first asked by Spolier, Fries, and Gondolo in 2007, and actually found that in the process of a collapse of a zero metallicity cloud, if you take into account the heating from WIMPs, this collapse can be prevented way, way, way before any sort of nuclear reactions can take place. In other words, you have an object in hydrostatic equilibrium that's supported by what? By pressure due to heating from dark matter annihilating. Those objects are called dark stars, right? And they, basically, those are the three conditions to form a dark star. You have to have sufficiently high dark matter densities, poor cooling mechanisms, and the annihilation products can thermalize. In other words, you don't end up with all neutrinos, because if you have models in which all the energy is lost, well, too bad. You won't form a dark star. But in the case of WIMPs, typically the fraction of energy that's thermalized is 2/3 or something like that, or the unit number. Now, can we grow these objects to be supermassive, right? So let's start with the HR diagram, which runs for reasons unknown to me. Temperature's hotter here, right? Cooler here. There's three evolutionary tracks in this HR diagram for dark stars powered by what's called extended adiabatic contraction. They start with, let's say, roughly one solar mass, and they grow up the tracks. The three different tracks are colored differently based on the mass of the WIMP powering them. Let's follow the red one, the middle one, the 100 GeV WIMP. So you see, it grows almost indefinitely. It continues to accrete. And the main reason it continues to accrete, well, let's look at the temperatures. Here's 10 to the fifth. Here's 10 to the four. So it's not going to emit enough photoionizing photons that would basically shut off the accretion. Those guys could accrete almost indefinitely. In other words, they could convert gas to stars to almost 100% efficiency. Keep that in mind, right? Now, the other mechanism, so this extended C means that, how do you justify this idea? Halos are not spherical. Many halos in simulations are seen to be triaxial. Because of this asymmetry, orbits are going to be, some of them chaotic, many of them centrophilic, so many orbits are going to pass arbitrarily close to the center. In other words, you have quite a large reservoir of dark matter orbits that go close to the center of the halo, all right? The other path towards forming a supermassive dark star is to say, okay, the initially adiabatically contracted reservoir can get depleted. Say, for example, you're in a spherically, perfectly spherically symmetric halo. There's no such funny business with chaotic orbits. Then you run out of dark matter that you initially AC'd. Then this phase here, well, constant luminosity, temperature increases, radius shrinks. That means you have a collapse phase. In that collapse phase, the density increases. And if now the dark matter particle interacts with the protons efficiently, you can start powering via the capture mechanism. Remember that capture mechanism we spoke before, right? So there's two tracks to building stars that are powered by, essentially, annihilations in dark matter, via capture or via adiabatic contraction, right? Now, why do we care about this? Before, it was just because theoretically they could be produced, right? But now I would try to convince you that they could solve two of the most major puzzles in astronomy today. They could be part of those solutions. One of them is, we have a collection of, quite a large collection of very massive quasars at high redshifts, right? To explain them, you need very massive black holes, which you do not have time to build as massive if you start for a regular, from even a thousand solar mass population three star. You just simply don't have enough time, which led some people to speculate that maybe you have no idea what cosmic time means. I'm not going to go there, right? I'm going to suppose there's an alternative solution. Well, you need heavy seeds. We need heavy seeds, right? And by now you know that. I'm going to just tell you, well, those stars, as they run out of dark matter, they will collapse to what? To a black hole, which is heavy. There's an alternative path. I'll discuss one such example, the UHZ1 puzzle, right? This guy is a quasar at redshift 10. That is powered by a black hole 10 to the 7. That's insane. Let me pause right there. This number for redshift 10 is just like, whoa, shocking. Moreover, it has an equally massive stellar population. This is the system UHZ1, which has demonstrated to us, to the community, that basically you have to have heavy seeds, right? Without doubts, UHZ1 is telling you, you have to have massive black hole seeds. And in this slide, I'm using a dark star that formed at, say, redshift 20. It accreted with an accretion rate. Well, there's a shade here, blue, red, 10 to the minus 2 or 10 to the minus 3 solar masses per year. So that's why you have sort of a split in. After it accreted at redshift 15, it's going to run out of dark matter, say, and collapse to a black hole, upon which it's going to grow as a black hole does. And we're going to have to assume it grows at the Eddington limit. But look at that. It's basically explaining UHZ1. And more than that, as a bonus in this corner, the other three most distant quasars, right? So yes, supermassive dark stars collapsing to black holes are a good explanation for this puzzle. They're not the only one. I have to be fair. There's another one that's really popular in the press. Now, you might have read about the direct collapse of black holes, right? If you didn't, that's OK. But definitely, UHZ1 has really put to the forefront this direct collapse black hole theory, even to the point of saying it's confirmed. Well, I don't know. I'm coming with an alternative here. Which one is better? We don't know yet. But let me just briefly tell you. For direct collapse black holes, the number of such black holes you'd produce is limited. It's just because of the way the scenario is formed. We can talk later if you all, but just know the fraction of halos that can hold a direct collapse black hole is rather constrained versus the ones that can hold a dark star. It's not as constrained. So with sufficient population of such quasars, you can start putting limits. Now we have to explain the stereo population as well. Okay, thank you. So as I said, UH1 contains about the same 10 to the 7 solar masses in stars. Well, how can we generate a system which contains also a remnant of a dark star and stellar populations? One scenario is the following. Imagine you have two halos in proximity on the verge of collapsing, right? In one such halo, you form at the center of it a dark star. In the other one, you have maybe population 3 stars forming or nothing. It can be just here, you can just have gas. So imagine either stars or gas. Either way, the halo containing the dark star would continue to allow it to accrete to supermassive status. When the merger happens, well, the dark star is going to be slightly dislodged from the center of the halo, right? And the dark matter densities are highly sensitive to the location. So if you just slightly perturb it, well, that guy is going to run out of efficient fuel, is going to collapse to a supermassive black hole. And more than that, this black hole, if it has gas around it, is going to trigger a very efficient star formation phase here. So in principle, you can end up with a system such as UHZ1. Now, the other puzzle, remember I was telling you that there's two puzzles that dark stars can solve, is this idea of the too many, too massive, too soon galaxies. I put here the 6 more prominent ones, the ones that almost broke Lambda CDM, the 6 Lavey galaxies. But really, at face value, what those guys are telling us is that we really don't know how the first stars and galaxies formed, but what we do know is that they must have converted the gas to stars to 100% efficiency, right? So no, they didn't break Lambda CDM. I'm going to just pause here because there's going to be a talk about that, right? The reason being, well, we have HST, but let me just leave you with this slide. There's a full talk about this, why Lavey galaxies didn't break Lambda CDM, because data from HST would disfavor that interpretation, which basically means we have to find a solution that doesn't lie in cosmology, but rather in astrophysics. Well, maybe the solution is, or part of the solution is, dark stars. Did we observe them yet? Well, we do have 3 candidates in this work published in 2023. The 3 candidates, well, those are images with the Webb telescope. Work done with Julian Pauline and Katie Fries. Julian Pauline, my former student, now at UPenn. Basically, what we've done is said, let's select some objects to analyze, right? We have dark stars, we have their spectra, let's analyze them. Let's first be rather strict and saying, I want to mess only with objects that have a spectroscopically confirmed redshift. I don't know, 3 months later to say, oh, I analyzed this object, but you know, it's a contaminant at low redshift. So let's just say Z greater than 10. Then, consistent with the point source interpretation, because those are stars after all, and yeah, then we have to match the available photometric or even spectroscopic data, if available, with templates of supermassive dark stars. Back then, 2023, we had this sample of 4 JADES objects, Z10, Z11, Z12, Z13, and we said, all right, let's run our templates of dark star spectra and see if we can fit those spectra. Now, we also were a little bit sort of lax in the grid. So we said, for the mass of the dark star, let's just take 2 per decade. So 10 to the 5th, 10 to the 6th, and in between. We didn't generate a very, very fine grid. We could have, but we said, let's just see what happens with this rather coarse grid. Well, and lo and behold, out of the 3 I showed you, out of the 4 I showed you, 3 are consistent with the supermassive dark star interpretation, which goes to tell us that if I were to do even a finer grid, I probably could find those very generically fitting photometric data of the Webb telescope, right? So let me go through the first one, the most distant one, the JZ13. And here's a parameter scan, Z versus mu, where mu, it's sort of a proxy for the mass. I mean, yeah, it could mean the gravitational boost factor, but it would also mean that if I take the mass to be 10 to the 6, actually a mu of 1.5 is telling me that the mass is closer to 1.5 10 to the 6, right? So either way, look, on this slide, I have here wavelength beans, which are throughput filters of the Webb. And yeah, the redshifted spectrum fits rather well at 95% confidence level with the photometric data, which are the points with error bars, right? Now you might notice something here on this slide. It's really profound deep. It's a signature, it's actually a smoke and gun signature of dark stars, this helium 2 absorption line. Some galaxies, nebular emission galaxies, would have here an emission line. But to our knowledge, no objects in those high redshifts would have such an absorption feature. Let's go to the next one, Jade Z12. Again, same parameter scan. We find a good fit, 95% confidence level. You might notice there's a bit of a difference between the slope of a continuum. Here, kind of fast. Here, kind of slow. That means this object is cooler. This object is formed via the AC mechanism versus this object is formed via the capture mechanism, right? And the third one we find, it's formed, again, by now you guess it, via the AC mechanism because of almost flat slope of the continuum. But either way, the main takeaway would be that it's not hard for us to find fits with photometric data. In fact, if I were to create a very fine grid of masses, I probably could fit almost any photometric data you could have, right? So we need actually to focus on spectral signatures, and our hope is that in the future, you know, either the JAIS team or we might even put proposals ourselves to seek this emission absorption feature and to confirm one of those either three candidates or the others we're continuing to find. So let me leave you with conclusions and outlook, right? We identified three, but most importantly, it's three of four. So that means their supermassive dark stars are generically good fits for photometric data of the web. And now what I want to point out is, you know, many times you see in the astronomy literature, all right, confirmed galaxy at redshift, I don't know, 11.5 or not. Why? Because they took spectra and they found an alignment break. The other features are a mess, signal to noise, I don't know, two, but you do have a clear break. And yeah, we call that a galaxy, just because there's a alignment break. No. Again, I could probably fit it with a supermassive dark star very quickly. So I'd say let's call it an object that's a confirmed redshift greater than 10, not a galaxy. In my mind, in view of what I explained right now, we shouldn't be so fast in calling objects that only have alignment break as their only feature in the spectra confirmed a galaxy, right? Why? Because the alignment break is due to neutral hydrogen along the line of sight, nothing to do with the object itself. So yeah, we need high signal-to-noise spectra to differentiate dark stars from galaxies. And yeah, maybe you have seen that actually one of the three JAIDS objects has a sort of a dip I'll show you in the last slide. So it's a tentative helium-2-1640 absorption feature. I don't know yet if we're going to, like with follow-up observations, that's going to be confirmed or not, but that's an object we're really excited about, right? And if we have, oops, sorry, I have to learn backward from forward. If we have a sufficiently high sample of dark star candidates or dark stars, even better, we'll start, you know, doing statistical inference tools to actually infer what's the parameters of dark matter. So far, we only simulated them for 100 GeV, 1 TeV, and whatever, 1 GeV WIMPs, but we can scan the full parameter space and, you know, really infer with the help of the first stars what dark matter could be. And I'll leave with this summary slide, and I'll thank you for your attention. Because the chi-squared was too large, right? So the we didn't investigate too much. Probably, so let's see. Let's go back. Good question, thank you. Let's see, what's the spectrum of the fourth object? Does this, oh, I think, no, I think for this one, let's see. Yeah, I remember the chi-squared was not within the 90% limit. So if we were to have a much finer grid, probably it would have worked, right? But we didn't. Yes.
Can you say more about how these are point sources? Because if I look, you know, look close.
Right, right. There's a bunch of red dots. Remember, there's the red dots, right? So they're point sources. Now it depends on, actually we had a little bit of a debate with the Jades team, which ones of those are point sources versus extended objects, right? And if you take the simplest Rayleigh criterion, they would be point sources. You just apply the Rayleigh criterion. Now the Jades team says, well, there's some subtleties around that, which I have to grant them, they're the experts, right? But even with those subtleties, they are consistent still with point sources, right? They're consistent either with really compact, they're really not resolved. They're really not well resolved. At the best, some of them are barely resolved, barely. So they're still consistent with both interpretations.
My understanding was when something truly is a point source.
Well, I mean, you know, you have an SPF, right?
So
you have
it shows like this hexagonal diffraction pattern.
Right, but at that distance, are you really going to see the secondary? Like at that distance, you're going to start.
It's not bright enough that you would see.
No, you wouldn't see. And in fact, one of the tests we propose, if they're really point sources, is to actually expose it a long, long, long time and start to seeing the secondary refraction pattern. Good question. But so far, they're consistent with both.
Would the test were compared with like just a standard black box model or some galaxy?
Oh, again, like I could compare them, but they're not apples to apples because in our fits, I took, remember, 2 per decade. So if I make my mass grid finer, I probably could find a chi-square that would be mind-blowing, right? So we have some, let's see if I have a table for that. Good question. Let me see. Got to bear with me here. All right. There we go. Galaxy. All right. So our chi-squared is here. That's the galaxy. So for some of them, we're better. For some of them, we're slightly worse. But again, I wouldn't really stress on that because, as I said, our mass grid was rather coarse. Right? Thanks for the question.
When you're growing these dark stars, how do you determine the accretion?
Very good. We just basically empirically determine it to be reasonable, right? And 10 to the minus 3 is reasonable. 10 to the minus 2 is reasonable. You know, constant accretion, right? That then gets shut off if you reach a critical temperature where the Lyman photon, the ionizing flux becomes too high, then you transition to zero. So we take a constant accretion rate that's either 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus, between 10 to the minus 3 and 10 to the minus 1. Sort of mess.
If you have like a 10 to the 5 solar mass halo, it's not obvious that you can sustain that high accretion rate.
Right. So the halos, very good. The halos we took is either 10 to the 7 or 10 to the 6 in that range. So 10 to the 6 for the molecular hydrogen cooling. 10 to the 7 for the atomic hydrogen cooling, which, by the way, dark stars could form in both of those chemistry scenarios.
Thanks.
Yeah? Yes?
What's special about the helium-2 absorption line?
Oh, because basically, in galaxies, you wouldn't see that, right? In galaxies, you either see an emission feature there if you have nebular emission galaxies, or there would be no feature. Now, the reason we have that line there is because you have enough neutral hydrogen or helium there, right? So it's special because it's not part of the other objects that have photometric data similar are galaxies, right? And they don't have such a feature. So it would be sort of a smoking gun signature, if you will. Thank you for the question.
Could this be that you model how the radiation from this black star interacts with the gas?
Excellent. So there's still the question of nebular emission, if you're talking about that, right? In the case of the cooler ones, we find that there's almost no nebular emission. So in the case of the ones powered by AC, we find that they're not hot enough to sustain ionization-bound nebula. In the case of the ones formed with capture, by the way, if I were to go back to the HR diagram, you would see that they're actually hotter. Or maybe, trust me, they're hotter, the ones formed at capture, right? Those actually could, if you have sufficient amount of gas surrounding them, they could form a nebula. So whatever I spoke about right now today are just pure dark star spectra. I didn't include any nebular emission spectra, which could complicate the issues or could make them even more easy to
determine how likely we will see this in the phase.
I see, because that would probably be swamped. That's true. Again, remember, if they reach a mass of 10 to the 6 solar masses, they probably accreted most of the baryons they could have. So,
So what are the prospects for getting more detailed spectra?
Well, last I know, the JS team was going to take follow-up spectra on those guys. I don't know when, if they already did, or if they're processing the data that we don't know, but they were interested in looking.
Would they be able to resolve that
time? We did estimates, and that's our estimates, how many months of exposure time would it take them. It's of the order of months, right? So, yeah, to resolve. Right, right. Yeah, so that's why. Right now, those are probably not the best candidates. And what we're doing now is to find a pipeline using a machine learning algorithm that we can pass all the photometric data and start to see if there's better candidates, like brighter, that we could actually find this feature with a shorter amount of exposure time.
You can see the stacking.
I guess one could do a stacking, right? But again, I'm not an expert in spectroscopy, so I shouldn't, like, you know, bet my money on it. Yes, Kay.
You said something about the direct class black holes maybe not having the right abundance, but you could get them with this mechanism. What determines the abundance you'd expect for these supermassive dark stars?
Right. So, okay. In the case of the direct class black hole, because you have to have two companion halos, one of them emitting enough Lyman-Werner radiation to basically, you know, destroy molecular cooling. That's why they're sort of seldom, right? In the case of dark stars, well, all we need is the three criteria: a star to form from a collapse of the gas cloud that's rather close to the center of the halo, right? Which, again, I don't know. We have to run simulations and see what's the fraction of gas clouds that collapse close to the center of the halo. Now, the gas clouds, once you introduce heating from dark matter, they would suppress fragmentation. That's known, right? So that, I wouldn't worry about fragmentation, but the location of the gas cloud, yeah, it should be aligned with the center of the dark matter halo, but how much aligned? Because you don't have a lot of wiggle room. It's about 10 AU where you have the 10 to 13, you know? So again, I don't know the fraction, but it could be potentially up to unity, you know? But certainly it's not as constrained as the direct class black hole scenario.
So it's a matter of the modeling just hasn't been fully done yet in terms of the abundance?
No, we don't know that. We know bounds from assuming they survive up to within HST era, but that's an assumption. You say, let's say they assume they survive up to redshift 10 where HST could observe them. Well, we didn't find them with HST, so you can place bounds that way. And then in that case, the fraction is 10 to the minus 4 or so, minus 3, but it's an assumption, you know. They survive up to the redshift, so they will be detected by HST, which I don't think that all of them would because of merger and all that. Yes?
You said something about low dark matter masses, something, asking later.
Yeah, very good. So remember how these Popper stars are excellent probes because they probe below the neutrino floor. But more than that, if you were to, say, look at sub-GeV dark matter, let's say we take WIMPs for now, S-wave or P-wave, well, I mean, sure, I'm not going to claim they're really doing better than direct detection experiments here, but okay, they cut a little bit of a sliver that direct detection are not, but that's not the exciting part. For me, the exciting part is if you take models that are really built to live in the sub-GeV phase space of the parameter, you know, sub-GeV masses, such as the COSIM dark matter model, we took this model, and then we said, okay, let's see what POP3 stars do. In terms of if I have a Popper star 1,000 or 300, the same shaded regions with red or blue, look at that. They really are extremely powerful here for the COSIM dark matter models. You have some loss of the sensitivity due to dark matter evaporation, but either way, they are really powerful sub-GeV dark matter probes for this COSIM.
At what mass do you evaporate?
So in here, you start to get evaporation. 10 to the minus 1 or so.
And why do your limits come back?
That's a very interesting question. I'm going to have to remind myself that. It's been 2021, but we will talk about it. No, I promise we'll talk about it. Because it was intriguing when we found it, but we can talk and I'll show you why. Yeah, yeah.
Any last question?
Yes.
The depths of these here seem very high. What are those scales on which you're assuming those densities?
Right. So the densities, again, remember I was doing this adiabatic contraction and we assume that the densities are 10 to the 13, 10 to the 16. Again, let's go up. There's a slide. If we take the fact that adiabatic contraction works, and it does because of simulations, right? The simulations are telling us that, yes, adiabatic contraction works. Now, the real question is, when the gas cloud collapses, up to what number density this process continues to work, right? And if you're really saying, oh, it's just going to go right above here, where basically the simulations probe, then you have an enhancement in the 10 AU, or up to 10 to the 9, right? Now, what we assume is, let's say they go up to 10 to the 13, which is this line, right? What's 10 to the 13? Then you have an enhancement of roughly exactly 10 to the 13 at 10 AU, right? And so 10 to the 16, again, you assume that the AC stops to operate at number density 10 to the 15th baryon per centimeter cubed, which is, again, well before the first protostars form, which is, I think, 10 to the 19, 22, right? So we're still giving a lot of wiggle room in this process. We don't know exactly when it's going to stop. Because why? Because simulations cannot probe yet that inner region. So we have to make some assumptions. And yeah, they look very high, right? 10 to the 13 is not a small number compared to what we have in this room. It's 10 to the 13 larger, so yeah.
No. That's not going to be great.